This is Dennis Allsop, recorded at Peterhouse College, Cambridge, on the 15th of September 2007 by Chris Eldon Lee. Dennis Allsop.
I'm Dr. Dennis Allsop, and I was born in Rotherham, South Yorkshire, in 1946.
And you are rather unique at this conference in that you were never employed by Bass.
That's right.
So what were you doing before you went south?
I used to work in a specialised unit at Aston University, which was part of the Department of Biological Sciences. And this was an information centre which collected scientific papers. It published information journals, both primary journals and bibliographic ones. And it carried out research, carried out contract research, and it taught on university courses. And the nature of the unit was biodeterioration. And this is the breakdown of products or materials of economic significance by living organisms. And at that time I was actually doing a PhD on the decomposition of cotton cloth for a biocide manufacturer. I was also the information and service officer of the unit. So I got a fellowship after I graduated and I was doing my PhD part-time.
All of which sounds fairly cosy.
Yeah.
Until something happened.
Well, what happened one day, into my room came David Walton of the Antarctic Survey. He was a native of Birmingham and he'd been doing some research on cellulose decomposition in the Antarctic, and I think probably by looking at the literature he'd realised we were working on it too. So as he came up to visit his parents in Birmingham, he popped in to see me, and we found we had quite a few mutual interests, photography and the microbiology and what have you. And I was talking to him about the standardised cotton cloth that we use for industrial work. This was a cloth called the Shirley Test Cloth by the textile Shirley Institute in Lancashire. And although it was well known as a test substrate in industry, the purer, shall we say, biologists had never heard of it. Anyway, to cut a long story short, it was out of stock at the time. And we got the Shirley Institute to weave another set of this very precisely defined cotton cloth, of which David bought a stock in, for work with in the Antarctic. So we collaborated on this test cloth, and we did some experiments to show how it decomposed, not that that was in any doubt, but just to set standards. And that was published in one of our own journals. So getting to know David, I asked him to come up and give a talk on the Antarctic Survey to our biological society at the university. Well, whilst he was doing that, they came up and showed us all the fantastic pictures and all the macho clothing and whatever. So it's a very popular sort of topic, you know. And one of my professors, Geoffrey Pugh, who died a couple of years ago, Geoffrey was always on the lookout for a jolly trip somewhere. And he asked David whether or not visitors were ever taken to the Antarctic. Well, the answer was yes. And we then sought to get research grants. And to cut a very long story short, about a year later, we got the funding in place for a proposal for him and me to go down and look at decomposition of plant and animal remains and the fungal side of it. Not a lot of microfungal work had been done. Some had been done by Bass, but very few independent operators had done any. So the thing was wide open. There was a lot to do.
Why did you feel it was worth doing?
Well, not a lot was really known about how things happen in microbiologically in a cold climate. We knew that some of these residues did they were bound to decay, but we had no idea at what rate. We had no idea what the causative organisms were. And we knew that some of them did accumulate. The moss banks, for instance, moss becomes a thick carpet, feet thick, with peat below it. It just gets bigger and bigger and bigger because there's very little decomposition. And when it came to animal remains, we don't know. And it's all really to do with the bigger picture of the recycling of elements in that biosphere, really.
Did you feel the work would be only important in the Antarctic itself, or could you relate it back to...
No, it's of more general significance, because what's in the Antarctic can relate to cold zones anywhere, and in fact, you know, cold storage might be in. We've had problems with what happens with cold stores, for instance, in Britain. I mean, regularly we freeze food, we know all about that. What happens to other materials? Can they stand it? Not a lot was known, if you were to say, you know, what happens, how fast? This is a question that laymen often ask, and it's how long is a piece of string, you know? The answer is, it depends. And it's something that can be measured and looked at quite quickly and quite cheaply. It's not rocket science. You just need a matchbox of soil and the usual lab techniques. Which begs the question, why go and do it all the way down there? One of the things is a lot of these organisms are quite fragile, actually. And having been, if you just bring them back, it's not quite the same. Otherwise, you could do a great deal of Antarctic work by just getting samples, but it's not the same thing.
Okay. You know? So you had a project,
yeah,
innovative and pioneering project. You had the funding.
Yeah.
What happened next? How did you actually get to go?
Right. Well, first of all, we had to get the university to let us go.
And was that problematical?
Well, it wasn't. It wasn't really. I mean, Jeff Pugh, being a prof, can do what he likes. But we had another professor who shall be nameless at the time, who was really very good at curbing enthusiasm for anybody who wasn't in his field. And I was very junior at the time. When we got the grant, there was really no reason why we shouldn't have gone. But I remember my immediate boss had gone on holiday when we were told we could do it. So I had to track him down on holiday and get him to phone the prof, and he really couldn't find an excuse to say no. So we were sort of signed up for it. So we then came down to Bass and picked our kit and were delighted to know that we could keep it, not realising what it looks like and smells like when it's covered in seabird vomit and what's left of a pair of boots walking on razor-sharp rock for weeks on end. So we got our bags packed and prepared to go down.
So this was 1979-80?
Yeah, we left on Boxing Day 1979.
How much preparation did you have? I mean, were you sent on courses to teach you how to operate in the Antarctic?
Nothing.
Nothing at all?
Not really, no. It was just assuming you were grown up, you were field biologists, you'd put a project forward that, you know, you were...
No induction course?
No, I believe there was something, but I don't think... I'm not sure whether they were never invited or it was inconvenient. Or Jeff Pugh couldn't go. But anyway, no, we didn't. Nothing at all, really.
So, and the fact that you were not a Bass person didn't seem to matter?
No. No, I mean, we were known to Bass personnel by then. We'd met them, we'd done work with them. It was just assumed that you were competent.
And how did you decide what to take in terms of technical support?
Well, we had to check what was available on the base.
And, which was more or less than you expected?
It was quite adequate. As I say, it's not rocket science what we did. Mm. We do consumables. What you need, a lot of glass bottles, a lot of media. A microscope, we did in fact send down a microscope of our own. because they're usually the things that are in a bit short supply, and I think we sent down one of our own and some consumables. But it didn't require any, in those days certainly, any big analytical machinery. We weren't doing DNA work, and we weren't doing cloning and sequencing, you know, that was, some of that had not yet been invented. We were just growing up organisms, and not even with incubators. I mean, we just sort of did it either warm was on the lab, you know, and cool was on the windowsill. And we were just growing them up, identifying them, and taking it from there, really.
So you travelled light?
Pretty much. I mean, we didn't carry much at all with us. We'd sent stuff down through Bass, but it was mainly consumables, media. Microbiologists always run short of these glass dishes, petri dishes, or plastic ones or whatever. You get through these, whatever project you're doing, you've never got enough of these, or bottles or media. But we did manage. There's also a limit to the amount you can actually look at in a day. So it's no good making 10,000 plates because you'll never actually look at them. There's got to be a...
The trip down, I've been reading the beginnings at least of your journal, of your 3 month trip to the Antarctic. The trip down reads extremely chaotically.
It was, yeah. It was an adventure in itself, really, the trip down. We set off okay, we got out of Heathrow okay, and within hours we were diverted into Portugal. We were stuck there overnight. We got down to Rio, tangled with all the Brazilian bureaucracy, got another flight down to Buenos Aires the next day. Then we got stuck, and for various reasons, which were always quoted as being political or security, they wouldn't let the Ransfield put in to places where we were. So having set off on Boxing Day, we ended up down in the Patagonian desert on New Year's Day to 1980, and where we had, the final problem was getting out of the Ransfield, and the Bass organisation had got a lot of contacts, obviously, and the Schmidt Lloyd 3 salvage tug was in Comodoro Rivadavia, and the crew had obviously had a fantastic New Year, and the barbecue was on deck, and they'd all got hangovers. But we sort of, don't know what money changed hands, but we were taken out on this. It was a beautiful morning, I remember it very well, but there was quite a swell running. And having smashed several big wicker fenders between the two ships, decided they'd swing out the crane from the Ransfield and take us with the tomatoes and potatoes and just lift us in a net, two or three at a time, onto the Ransfield. So we ended up on the Ransfield.
Were you comfortable with that?
Yeah, I was actually. Well, the bottom actually slipped, so we were at an angle. But it's a lot nicer doing that than grabbing rope ladders in a moving sea or jumping from boat to boat. That's very dangerous. I've done it a lot, but it's still very dangerous. So that was all right. And then we sailed on, and I think we ended up on Cygne on the 7th of January. So it was quite a...
And what did you find? One of the reasons for doing these interviews is to see how Sydney developed over the decades, and you were there right at the very beginning of the 1980s. What impressed you about Sydney? What's your images of Sydney at that time?
Well, we were told that it was always full of mank. It was always going to be very grey and dank and whatever. And it never was that bad, actually. I think it was quite a fairly gloomy day the day we arrived. But very different, I suppose. You've got the instant impression that there is wildlife around. You've got the impression that it's a very rugged place. I mean, you know, anyone, unless if they've been, you know, and had a history of walking in hills and going to the Lake District and the Scottish Mountains and this sort of thing, probably expect something fairly rugged, and it certainly is. I suppose, I mean, at the time I was, 34, and Geoffrey was in his, well into his 50s. And of course, all the young men, most of them anyway, were in very early 20s. And I think certainly, you know, see him had Jack Dernell. Our base commander was Dave Roots. I mean, a wonderful bloke, but he looked then so youthful. It was quite incredible, you know. I was expecting a base commander to be a wizened old sea captain, you know, and this child who'd never shaved appeared, and, you know, I mean, he used to get his leg pulled a bit. But he'd already done several winters there. And he ended up getting the Polar Medal and the Fuchs Medal, and he's still very active, and, you know, he's quite famous for his polar work. But
so there was a potential for a barrier or a gulf between the two sets of people, the two scientists from Aston and the much younger regular Fids.
I don't think that ever raised it, actually, at all, because we were all in the same boat. You're all dressed the same. I think if anyone had raised any airs and graces or asked for special treatment, they'd have been told in no uncertain terms to, you know, get a life and get with it. Mm. And you realise there was so much you didn't know. You had to, you know, it's like going to a new school. You had to learn the jargon. You had to learn the routine. You had to fit in. You had to fit in with the routine of the base. You took your share of the cleaning and the washing and everything else, and heavy work and chipping rust and mixing concrete and all that sort of thing, which is quite right.
Did they tell you that before you went?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we were told, you know, you can't go and say, I am a scientist, you know. That does not go down well. I'm sure it must have happened from time to time with visitors, but that's not the way to win friends and influence people at all.
So socially, there was no real trouble at all?
No.
And when you saw your quarters, were they what you imagined? Or?
Oh, they were fine, yeah. I mean, it was in what they call the Plastic Palace now, which is now being demolished, but I mean, the pit rooms were shared bunk rooms, two or four people, but that was okay. The place was very warm. The food was fantastic.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I mean, I put weight on no end. I mean, I think the calorie allowance was, 7,000 or 9,000 calories a day, designed for young men using dog sledges. Not older men sitting in laboratories looking down microscopes, you know.
Was the food by that time mostly brought in by ship, or was it stuff that was caught and captured locally?
Oh, it was all brought in.
Right.
I mean, caught and captured, nothing. I mean, we ate a penguin while we were there that was found dead, but, you know, interfering with the wildlife for food was long gone. Dogs had gone by then,
So
you weren't shooting seals for dog meat. Little fresh stuff. Occasionally, when boats had been to the Falklands, you'd get some fresh material, fresh oranges. I remember some oranges coming during one call of a ship, and we had a fantastic burst of penicillium infection on all our samples. And it was bringing an infection on oranges onto the base. And we wondered what on earth was going on. We got this penicillium, and then it took us a couple of days and we realised. Because the actual normal atmosphere is better than an operating theatre out there. You know, you can take a Petri dish, take the top off, leave it outdoors. It's a common enough trick to show people to test. And I remember, I think we left one out for 6 hours once. I think it got one colony on. The air's incredibly pure. Even though there's animals crapping all over the place, you know, lots of bacteria, but not a lot of fungal spores. I mean, anyone who suffers from hay fever, I think, which is in many cases fungal rather than pollen, it must be a wonderful place to go.
So the oranges disturbed your work?
Yeah, but not for long. I mean, we just wondered why we'd got a lot of this penicillium on it, but we realised that.
But on the other hand, fresh oranges must have been quite a treat.
Yeah.
You were only there for 3 months.
Yeah.
You've been there for years.
Yeah. Oranges. Some meat was obtained from the Falklands, but that was frozen. I mean, geese. And some mutton and sheep were brought in. I mean, the things that we didn't have fresh eggs, apart from when a particular ship called, one of these cruise liners, and the winters went out and brought fresh eggs back. I mean, that really is a big, big deal, a fresh egg. And salad, well, illegally, I think, you're not allowed to bring any foreign plants into the Antarctic.
Well, even 25 years ago?
No, but I mean, somehow tomato and lettuce seed appeared from somewhere and was grown in a greenhouse. And you know, with great deal of thought, you can get a tiny little shoot of lettuce. You know, I don't think I ever saw a homegrown tomato, but some tiny little lettuce. But I don't think Antarctica is going to be overrun by lettuce, to be honest, or tomato. So, no, you didn't get fresh salad.
Were you able to maintain contact with home or Aston? Or?
Just about. I was reminiscing with someone last night. We had, and we didn't know what the rules were until we were actually there. I think we were allowed 100 words a month by telex as a freebie. And if there was a sort of emergency, you could send out and pay for yourself a telex as a telegram, which could take up to a week, which went via Bass at Cambridge. That was it. I mean, now I believe the base is certainly Rotherer. It's got an extension from Cambridge. Just pick the phone up. and presumably, you know, satellite phone calls.
But you had no need to talk to Birmingham University?
No, no. Well, you know, the motivators were ourselves. Nobody else knew about the work. We were our own masters in what we did, which is nice. So you can please yourself exactly what you're doing.
One thing I noticed talking to other chaps is that they didn't really have a routine as such. That they worked through the night when they felt like it and slept in the daytime. Did you have a clear cut daily timetable?
No. Well, we knew it was really governed by what was coming up on the work. We'd take samples. We'd plate them out in the lab and wait to see what grew. And then if a lot grew, you had a lot of work. If not much grew, you'd be taking more samples. So you worked on material and you did what you could or wanted to do on what transpired. Mm-hmm. But certainly the timetable, you can become nocturnal. You can go through, and especially if people have difficulty sleeping with the lightness. I know I found that rather difficult. There's a tendency to stay up very late talking and chatting and going to bed very late and then getting up late. I mean, in a way it doesn't matter, but anarchy can break out like that. You know, if you're working in teams, visiting scientists, in a way, it doesn't really matter. It's up to them. You know, it's no good if the cooks decided not to get home. You know, there's no lunch. You've got to watch this sort of thing.
And what about hygiene? Was that, by the time you got there in 1980, was hygiene fairly easy to maintain, or were you still struggling?
It was easy in a way, but, I mean, showers were limited. But we seemed to manage without a big deal. I remember my wife saying how when I said about washing the towels, and she said, "Well, how did you wash them when you were away?" And I said, "Wash towels? Don't know whether I ever did actually. It's never sort of worked dirt off with it. It's a very clean atmosphere, although that's a bit of a contradiction in terms when you think of." All the mess and vomit you get involved in. But, you know, you get that off with water beforehand. I mean, on a Saturday night, you'd be wearing a suit. Mm. I've launched boats wearing a suit and a bow tie. I mean, you know, the British.
How do you mean?
We're British, for God's sake. No.
You didn't put it on specially, did you?
Yeah.
Did you?
Not to push the boat out. No, I was having my dinner, but we dressed up on a Saturday night. Yeah. People would put a shirt and tie on and a suit. I mean, there was even a talk when we went down, because we were passing through the Falklands, of whether we should take a dinner jacket with us, in case the governor asked us as visiting scientists to have dinner. Well, we didn't, and he didn't, so we were all right. But, you know, we got a dark suit and a smart shirt and a tie, and everybody dressed up. You know, it was certainly a jacket and tie job on a Saturday night.
It sounds as though the standards at the base have come a long way quite quickly since the 60s and 70s.
Oh yeah, it wasn't scruffy. I mean, we did a scrub out in the, you know, the plastic cut. I think once you've got conditions that look as though they can be cleaned, you know, we weren't using solid fuel. There weren't the old airborne stoves and things like that. The heating was electric, so the place wasn't full of smoke and soot. Mm. So it was essentially clean. So there'd be a scrub out once a week, and you know, I remember polishing the brass strips at the bottom of the doors with Brassell. You know, and
so there was pride in the place.
Oh yeah, very much so. You know, the boots came off downstairs, and you'd walk about in your socks or slippers upstairs, or your indoor shoes. I mean, if people start walking in covered in seabird vomit or whatever, they're not going to be very popular. So people didn't.
The other thing which seems to have changed around that time is the attention that was paid to health and safety. Were you conscious of anything significant in the health and safety?
Yes, it was bloody dangerous.
Can you elaborate?
Well, let's think. I remember unloading things was always, shall we say, rugged. One thing was barrel hauling. We unloaded inflammable stores from scows onto the beach near the old oil tank. And these were brought up to the base by being pulled up up rails on a little trolley and then transferred to a trolley that followed the contours. And how this was done was you attached a rope, and it's like the old Hoffnung tale with the wheelbarrow, you know, going up and coming down. A load of people would hold a rope and run down the hillside, which pulled the barrel up the other end. And so you were running, not with someone in front, you couldn't see where you were going, really, in big, heavy boots, over very sharp rock. And, you know, one fall there, you'd either hit the rock going downhill or somebody would trample you. Didn't happen, but it was quite scary at the time. And I remember someone saying, go and make some coffee for us, you've had enough, you know, you've done your bit. But, you know, you took part in that sort of thing.
So there's nobody going around with a clipboard saying, well, we ought to assess this situation?
Not to my knowledge, no. I mean, the things that are going in the wild, I think we were very careful. I mean, it's very eye-opening when you get there and you've got a rucksack and a morphine syringe is given to you.
Yeah.
You know, an automatic syringe of morphine and for when you fall into the crevasse, you know. And one or two instances, I remember going out in a boat, and I think boating's been curbed quite a lot, but we took two RFDs up to North Point one day.
RFDs?
They're inflatable dinghies with outboards on. And when we got there, it was a bit rough, and we decided we really should go back. And I remember having to turn round in the troughs of the waves, which is, you know, you've got to do it quick, otherwise, you know, you broach. And during this, the fuel line came off the motor and it stopped. But at least I got an experienced helmsman there who just connected it, prayed like mad, pulled the starter, and we got going again. But it's not the first sort of close call I've had. Well, yeah, close call, but it could have been. So there's things like that. It happens when you are in that sort of setup, really. No, I think really the biggest risk is food poisoning.
Really?
Yeah. and fire. Two things. Food, I mean, apart from falling down a cliff or falling over, in which case you are careful and you don't do stupid things, that the two main risks are fire. So every week there was a full breathing apparatus fire practice, you know, with hidden bodies and all this, and we always did that. And there was always a night watchman. There was someone awake who did the clearing up during the night in the lounge. So someone was on fire watch all night. And the other's food poisoning. And as far as I remember, there wasn't a single outbreak of tummy bugs that were food-related. Might have been a few that were drink-related, but food-related while we were there, because the standard of washing up... And it's funny, because when I was writing up my journal, although we had people on Gash who were clearing up, I don't remember how we washed up, and I think it was all done by hand in big sinks. Don't think we had a dishwashing machine. I think I would have remembered it if we had. And it was washed up. It was washed up immediately. And things like the tin opener were scoured. And I've always got a thing about tin openers now. I mean, it always gets washed, you know, every time you use it. So food poisoning and fire are the main ones.
Well, but the fire's obvious. The food poisoning I'm not quite so clear about. What were you concerned about?
Well, if standards of hygiene in the kitchen were low, if people, you know, helping with food preparation or washing up or being around didn't wash hands, didn't clean utensils, didn't wash up plates, left food around to go off, that's potentially a problem. So that was always taken good account of.
Cold climate didn't reduce the risk.
Well, it was not cold indoors, you see. No. I mean, once it's out of the fridge, it's, you know, it's pretty warm on the base. So we had excessive power. I mean, we had more power than we could use. So it could have gone off.
More power than you could use.
Well, the generators were capable of generating more power, and I believe in the summer they had, I don't understand how electricity works, but in the summer they had an artificial load which sort of mopped up excess electricity. In the winter, I think they did use a lot, but no doubt now they've got all sorts of gizmos and air conditioning and whatever, but...
How was the waste, human waste, dealt with in that period? Because, again, the earlier guys would just simply go down to the water's edge with it.
Oh, same, really. Except it wasn't the water's edge. There used to be a loo on the end of the jetty with a little flag. But now it was indoors, and there were two WCs. These were kept ice-free by running the condensing coolant from the stills, the water stills, but it's still water, for the labs, into the WC bowls, and that warmed the water up, and there was a constant slight flow down. It was just a straight raw sewage out to the end of the jetty.
Which
is why possibly we didn't eat the notothenoid fish that sort of swam around there waiting for it. The other thing which could have been remarkable was the fresh water, how that was collected, because what happened was there was a big tank of... In the winter, it was snow-blocking. Digging snow, melting it in a tank round the generator exhaust. In the summer, it was collecting rainwater. Now, there was a big pool, and as we saw earlier on today, a pool big enough to put a canoe in on the hillside. And that was fed by laying hose pipes up the hillside into puddles. And as the meltwater accumulated, it ran into this water. Now, being a biologist, you know, when I see water that's bright green, I know there's something growing in it. You've got a big tank, there's all the birds flying over, dropping the old guano in, full of nitrogen. You know, if it was your garden pond, you'd be worried, because you wouldn't be able to see the goldfish. But that's what we drank. That's as another blank in my memory, possibly, is what did we do with the water? Whether it was filtered or not. But we drank water. We must have filtered it in some way. But water came through taps, and water came out of showers, and it never seemed to present a problem.
Let's go back to the research work, because you were there for 3 months, which is a remarkably short period of time. Did you achieve a great deal in those 3 months, do you feel?
Well, we managed to publish a paper out of it. That's not necessarily an answer, but...
Well, that was a minimum requirement, I guess, wasn't it?
Well, you have to do something, otherwise you can justify doing it. Yeah, we did quite a lot, actually. We had a look at the plant waste. In fact, we extended the project while we were there, because we found some of it wasn't producing as many results as we might have done. So we extended our range of sampling. Only when you're there can you do that.
So you were sampling what now?
We were sampling residues of the two plants you get there, the Dischampsia antarctica and the little Caryophyllaceous thing. Leaves, fresh leaves, also the stuff that had died back, but also animal residues. We were looking at animal-enriched soils, both bird colonies and seal colonies, and looking for what fungi we could find in that, being mycologists. Now, it would have been nice to actually have looked at the bacteriology more, but that would have made it a bigger project, and we were not bacteriologists. And there are a lot of bacteria in there, which rather masks out some of the fungi. We got a fair amount of results on there, and clarified, I think, the sort of microfungi that are important or were important, and at least that gives a marker for future work of what was going on then, basically. So if that's sort of repeated, whether it be the same, we don't know. If there's any warming, there obviously is warming going on, and that could well influence the fungi.
So in retrospect, you feel it's quite important work?
Oh, I'm not going to say it's important or not. Everybody says that. It was done. It was sound, I think. It was interesting. And it's there.
Was there anything which stopped you from completing the work or finding the conclusions you wanted? Lack of facilities?
Well, again, as I say, it's like how long is a piece of string? Yeah. If we'd been there a year, if I'd had three technicians, if we'd had a lot more facilities, you'd just do it bigger and bigger and bigger. Whether or not, I think there's always, for these basic biological studies, there can be a diminishing return. Mm. You know, you can do a year's worth and it perhaps won't be much more significant.
You came back feeling quite satisfied with the work you did.
Oh, yeah.
Were there special days? Were there days when something unusual happened? Were there particular incidents that you recall?
Work-wise?
Just generally in Sydney.
Oh, yes, I think there always are. I think with that, the general climate can change very quickly. So if you're out and about doing your work or just, you know, touring, as it were, you can come across things you've never seen before. You can get sights you've not seen. I mean, everyone took pictures like crazy. I took hundreds and hundreds. And suddenly you get a different view. You know, an hour goes by and all of a sudden the strait's full of tabular icebergs and you think, where they come from? You know, or you get a sunset the like of which you've never seen before.
No 2 days are the same.
No 2 hours are quite the same, really. And people had said how awful the weather was there, and I really wasn't expecting the breaks that we did get. We did have dull days, but we got a lot of spectacularly good days too.
Other key days would be the arrival of a ship.
Oh yeah, I mean, mail, getting a letter is very important in these things, and you work out whether or not it's likely to get a letter because you've plotted the route. You've said, if so and so, if my wife writes, and if she wrote last week, it'll have got to Cambridge, and then it'll got to the Bransfield, and Bransfield's at sort of Rotherham, and then pick up mail at the Falklands, and you've worked out that it could be a letter, and there isn't one, or you get nothing. I mean, I got several letters on the day I left. On the boat that took me away. There were about four letters from my wife at that time. But people, and when you look at the people who've been there a long time, some of the lads who were on the base then, who got a pile of stuff from home, they get their mail and they go away and read it quietly for a little while, just to check on the bad stuff, if there is any, And then everybody gets together and they've got the local newspaper maybe sent down, and there's the odd knick-knack that someone's put in. I remember one little thing where somebody's sister had sent down two little wind-up bath toys. And these obviously were thought of as being really cool, would be the one word. And, there's all these hardened fins rushing to fill up the bath and race these two plastic penguins or ducks or whatever up and down the bath, complete nutters. But, you get things like that. They were very light-hearted in that they just got the mail from home. And
did he feel homesick? For example, you were in the Antarctic on your wife's birthday, weren't you?
Yeah, I was, yeah. And I got three small children. Well, I wrote things down, and I do get a bit homesick, my wife is very capable, and she's not a pathetic sort of person, so I knew she would be able to manage. On the other hand, that's no reason to think, what the hell, just go off for 3 months and no consequence. So you're conscious of that, and you're conscious of what they're giving up. I mean, having three small children, my wife, never murmured about me going there. She realised it was something I wanted to do. She looked after three small children, including one who was 6 months old, and ran the household. And when I got home, she was the tired one, really. I think this is probably one of the reasons why I think Bass stopped married men going. It can lead, I think, to too many domestic problems if you're actually missing for a year. I mean, if you go to prison, you get visitors. If you go down the Antarctic, you don't. So it's not really fair to send...
Some people describe going to the Antarctic as one of, if not the most significant... things they've done in their life. Would you go along with that?
Yeah, I would, yes.
What's so special
about it? As an experience. It's not just visiting a place. I mean, I've visited China, I've visited India, I've visited South America, Central America, various places in the world. And that's visiting a place and meeting people. But you've always had the option there of saying, right, don't want to be here, going home, take me to the airport. When you go to the Antarctic, that's not possible. So you can't have the dubious luxury of not getting on with people. You have to get on with people, and you have to fit in with them, and you have to act to a greater or lesser, usually a greater extent, as a team. You are depending on other people for your life. If the boatman's an idiot, you're in trouble. If the cook's incompetent, you're in trouble. If the wireless operator's no good, you're in trouble. If the Jenny Mex can't, you're going to freeze to death. You are dependent on this. There's no room for arrogance. There's no room for saying, we're the scientists, you are the workers in the vineyard sort of thing. So And the remarkable thing, I think, that makes it is that when you try, at least in my experience, when you try to get on with people, you don't just rub along with them, you actually do get on with people.
Do people actually subdue their own excesses? Do you notice people, if you like, modifying their character or reducing their eccentricities or their extremities? No, there was a dampening effect.
No, I don't. I think people were quite, you know, characters, but I think they must modify their they must realise consciously or subconsciously that they can't just be utterly individualistic. You'd have anarchy then. I mean, there wasn't a regime of... It wasn't a military regime. It wasn't one where we all, you know, assemble for muster at 9 o'clock in the morning and got our daily tasks. But, you know, we knew what was going on that day and that was that, and we got on with it.
So people didn't subdue themselves. They were more tolerant of each other.
Yeah, I think that's probably how we would say that. I mean, I don't know what they were like when they weren't on a base, to be honest. So maybe they were a bit different when they were back here.
How did you feel when you had to leave?
Quite upset, actually. It was very emotional. I remember going out to the ship and standing on the monkey bridge, and normally what happens is as you leave they blow the ship's sirens, and the people on the left on the land set off distress flares, and then you steam off, and I was in tears, to be honest, and I thought, why, you know, this is a lump of, it was a greyish day, a lump of frozen rock, I was going home, I thought, you know, well, what is it? And I thought, well, you know, I've had a great experience with great people. I've had a very intense experience, which is one's come through. You know, you've not been eaten by anything, and you've done the job, and you've had the experience, and you've got, you know, some good tales to tell. So it was really, you know, a very positive experience.
Is it losing innocence? Is it leaving a place of innocence? Simplistic place.
There might be something in that, because it is a rather, shall we say, spiritual, in the sense of reducing things to essentials. When I got back, I was irritated by certain things. One was advertising, the necessity for locking things away. Having to use money, these sort of things of essentials of civilization, so-called, and realise what the importance of people. I think when you've had a glimpse of that, you think, well, you know, why doesn't the world wake up and actually get on with doing it like that? There's not so much squabbling.
This may sound like an odd final question, Dennis. You're the first JP I've interviewed who's been to the Antarctic.
Yeah.
Did that experience in any way help to shape your sense of justice?
Well, I became a JP a long time after I'd been to the Antarctic, but you're the first person who's actually suggested that, but actually there might well be something in that. I think seeing another point of view and realising that people live in very different ways, and realising that human beings have to try and rub along, it probably does. I think probably it gives you some sense of humanity. You'd have to be a really... really arrogant bastard to remain an arrogant bastard if you went down to the Antarctic, to be honest. It's a humbling experience, and I think most people are probably shaped for the better.
Have you had people in front of you on the bench who you'd like to ascend to the Antarctic? because it would do them good.
Well, it's funny, actually. A lot of people you see in front of you are not hardened criminals. They're people who are inadequate, unfortunate, or whatever. I'm not saying it, you know, it's just all society's fault. You know, people break laws and they know they shouldn't do it. But I've often said, wouldn't it be nice if we had the solution of the safe, clean, interesting place people could go to and to develop. And I've always said, you know, we need some farms in Scotland, and people say, what have the Scots done to deserve being sent a load of criminals? But, you know, if you could say to young men, right, come on, you've got a lot of energy, you know, you've got to rely on people. I mean, you see these things with young criminals being, they go abseiling to learn to trust one another, and, you know, and apparently, you know, that's a good experience for many people. I'm not saying it would work for everyone. But that sort of experience, if it could be provided, I think would do a lot of people a lot of good. It would stimulate them, give them a different vision.
The Antarctic is a healing environment.
I think so, yeah. But it'd be rather expensive to set up camps there. Yeah.
Dennis, thank you very much.
My pleasure.